Yeah, we worked out the new intro, but
we did a new outro too.
Yeah,
where I said hello.
But if you listen to last week's episode, I try a new intro and then we immediately say that we should scrap that intro and then just this episode say how fucking awful it was and revert back to the old one. So that's...
Are we going to do that?
Oh yeah, we're doing that. So welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and sitting on the couch, as always, next to me is my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And Colleen is curled up next to him. We might hear from her this episode, we might not. And Harvey's wandering around the floor somewhere.
Doing odd things and stepping on shit.
Yeah.
Good intro.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's get back to the...
Yeah, so the film we watched this week was number 102 in the Criterion Collection, The Discreet Charms of the Bourgeoisie, the 1972 film by Louis Bonnoy.
Yes.
Yes.
A surreal film.
Yes.
Have you seen any of his other work? I think you mentioned you saw two of them.
Yeah, right? I've seen two. I've seen Belle de Jour, which is also in the collection, which is a wonderful film, kind of very visually guided and very slow and evenly paced, and it's a film about a upper-class woman who finds, to escape the mundane life that she's living, she decides to become a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really wonderful movie, also in the collection. The other one I've seen is a short film, probably the most famous short film ever made, from 1929, Un Chien Andalou.
Which, I've never heard of it.
Co-directed by Salvador Dali.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Yes. So those are the two films of Bonnoy.
So he is like deep within the surrealism movement.
Yeah, yeah. The film he co-directed it with Dali. I think they came up with the idea together, and it was pretty much Dali was kind of intrigued by the whole cinematic style and like that kind of medium. So he and Bonnoy he used him as, you know, his guiding hand into like, how do the moving pictures work?
Yeah, I want to make something that's got moving pictures in it.
And it's a 16-minute long silent film that is just images. And it's like it's surrealist images, and whatever you take from it is what you take from it.
Sweet, I like that kind of shit.
Yeah.
It
has some really rough shit, like a razor blade going across a fucking eyeball and stuff. Like
a real eyeball?
Yeah, it's got some gnarly shit in it.
Whose eyeball?
The lady in the movie, and like a wolf hand coming through a wall and grabbing her. It's really fucking gnarly.
Wow, that's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
This film was a little less crazy than that.
Yeah.
As far as surrealist stuff, it's not like overboard.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's not much of a plot either, and it's more just like a series of upper class folk.
Yeah.
Doing their best to have dinner party.
That's really all it is for an hour and 40 minutes. It's a group of five rich upper-class people, friends, trying to get together and have a dinner party and continually being interrupted and interrupted and interrupted, and wacky and weird scenarios happen. And then they keep rescheduling, and then they'll try again and reschedule and try again. And it's fucking bizarre.
So, yeah, there's... it's hard to pinpoint what's going on beyond the basic, like, this is a film about poking fun at the upper class societies.
Yeah.
This is a film about kind of a cynical look at those kinds of people and trying to, you know, let's try and break down that reality and show how silly it can be.
Yeah.
So it's a comedy.
Yeah, yeah. It's absurdist. I did get elements where I kind of... The odd scenes, they end up becoming so wacky and bizarre that I started to get a bit of a Monty Python vibe a little bit from it.
Mm.
In particular, how some scenes would just end with, like, everyone's under arrest.
Like, yeah.
It's just like, you didn't know how to end this scene or this sketch, so let's just kill everyone or put everyone under arrest or...
It just doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Every scene starts normal, then something strange will happen, like, I don't know, the chicken is not really chicken.
And then they turn around and there's a giant curtain behind them and they're on stage.
Yeah, and they have to do a performance about being...
guests at a dinner party.
Yeah, so if you're on board with kind of that wacky situational comedy...
Yeah.
But it's not... I wouldn't say it's like... it's own brand of situational comedy too. It's not in your face. It's very subtle. If you're not on board with that, I think that it's not, like, it's not a film that you're going to really enjoy.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy that kind of comedy?
I do.
Because we weren't laughing
in,
that much.
In small doses. I mean, I laughed out loud a few times, but I think I enjoy that kind of comedy and this type of filmmaking in small doses. I don't necessarily enjoy it for nearly 2 hours.
Okay.
That's not to say that this was a bad film, but I think, like, when the end credits finally rolled, we all were like, oh, okay, cool, thank God. Like, we weren't just like, brava! Like,
yeah.
It's,
on the whole.
Yeah.
Because I expected it to get, I wasn't aware of what it was to begin with.
Yeah.
And then slowly you realize, hey, they want to eat, they're not eating.
Yes.
Something's stopping them from eating. And so that happens again and again, scene after scene, until you realize, oh, this is the thing. Like, it's just going to be scene after scene of them trying to eat. And hopefully it's going to just get wackier and wackier until it's just, like, balls out, surrealist, crazy shit going on. It didn't get... It didn't ramp up.
Yeah, I was just about to ask, like, so. So that was your end game. You were hoping that the film would just slowly descend into madness, pretty much, like...
Yeah, and I wanted beyond, like, I wanted it to be beyond Monty Python stuff. I wanted it to be...
Like, just, beyond, like, where did the fish go? Who died?
Yeah, well, yeah, like, not that kind of stuff. But yeah. I wanted, like, let's take it into, like, a fantasy realm. Have you ever read The Third Policeman?
No, you've talked a lot about that, though. And,
it's super cool. I got vibes from that slightly, but it's, that book... I don't know if there's ever been an adaptation. It's probably people wanting to make a film based on this book, but it's an Irish book. And it's about, it's situations that are just totally random, like this film. And it's stuff like, you know, you'll learn about the atomic theory, where if you interact with something enough, you'll swap atoms and become partly that thing. So according to atomic theory, we're partly the Criterion Collection.
Right.
Where there's, like, no difference. Or, like, there's situations where there's, like, a policeman, and he's so in love with his bike, he uses it so much that he is 30% bicycle. And his bicycle, therefore, is 30% him. So his bicycle has a part of his personality, and it runs off and does random shit as well.
Yeah.
So that sort of stuff is just wacky, crazy, fucking weird shit that is on another level to this film.
Yeah.
So I wanted the film to keep ramping up till you get to that kind of wacky level of surrealism.
Yeah.
But it didn't.
Well,
so...
Like, my kind of end goal... Like, I totally agree with you. Like, the idea of wanting it to ramp up and kind of get to that beyond level. And you get kind of little glimpses of it. Like, when the military come and they all of a sudden have enough food and stuff, the military join them for dinner, and then they all of a sudden have to all leave because of secret orders... But they get the messenger to tell the story of his dream, which is just weird.
Yeah.
And then, like, on top of that as well, then there was, like, obviously the part where it's all, you know, they're expected to be doing a play of having dinner. Like, all of the dream sequences end up becoming very weird. But, like, my end goal, I was so hoping it would get to the bizarre realism where it was, like, they are dinner.
Yes, that kind of stuff.
That's kind of what I was so hoping that this would end up as, and it's like, doesn't quite get there.
Yeah.
But
so I felt like, it's a good film.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm not really sure, I mean, and yeah, it's both, I guess, it depends on how far you want to take your surrealist stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure really how to, if I really enjoyed it, I like the wacky stuff, but it wasn't wacky enough.
Yeah.
But I shouldn't really... It doesn't have to be wacky, like, more wacky than what it is. So it's like, do I really need to start hating on it?
I think
because of that? Probably not.
I don't think so. And I think it's actually going to be one of those films where you don't think it's affected you as much as it actually has. And in, like, a couple of days or a couple of weeks, you're going to get, like, weird memories, I think, of, like, or weird scenarios kind of pop into your head for no reason, I think, from this.
Yeah,
because that's what surrealist art does. Like, it just, every now and again, you'll be like, what the fuck was that? Like,
yeah, I don't understand.
Yeah, it's yeah.
Too wacky.
Well, just moving aside from the kind of the narrative or lack thereof and the kind of surrealist bizarre scenarios of it, was there anything else that you found that kind of drew you into the film, whether it be like performances or cinematography or music or anything? Was there anything that kind of made you latch on more than just seeing where this wanted, where it was going to go in terms of the surrealism?
Well, the performances were, I'm going to say that they were like, they're kind of easy characters to do.
Yeah.
Because you just have to play like a super square.
Yeah, well, not even a super square, like just a piece of shit. A rich upper crust.
Yeah.
A bourgeoisie.
Like a caricature.
Like, yeah.
A caricature. So you can make it simple and it works. So, there's nothing wrong with the performances.
Yeah.
And they did a really good job with the performances, but I'm not
sure. There's nothing stand out.
Yeah. I'm not sure that it'd be hard to fuck up. Like,
yeah.
It'd be, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, it sounds like I don't like the movie, but I do.
Yeah, it's just a hard one to kind
it's
of...
Let me just sit and...
Well, the one kind of main note that I put down in terms of, like, just before you were mentioning, like, it's supposed to... It's a surrealist comedy, yet we weren't necessarily laughing out loud all that much, and it wasn't really making us chuckle or smile, and it was like the issue of, do we understand the comedy, or like, you know, is it affecting us? I had in my head, like, it just reminded me of this bit from 30 Rock, actually,
mm-hmm.
where Tina Fey meets Carrie Fisher, who's like an old comedy writer from the 70s, and she's like, oh, don't you remember the mailbox sketch? And just like a shot of a mailbox falling over, they're like, yeah, political skewering, right? Like, and it's like, oh, I guess you had to be there.
So you're saying this is a film made in 1972 and it has...
I think if you saw it in the 70s, you'd be like, yeah, fucking...
Take that upper crust.
Yeah.
Bourgeois fucking...
Take them out, they're roasted. Like, yeah, it's...
Probably, yeah, maybe. But then it should be timeless because there's always a class system. Always.
Yes.
So everyone should be able to recognize that it's fun to laugh at the upper class silliness. So, and the jokes were good. Like, the jokes were well set up.
There was
the idea that a bishop just wants to be a gardener.
Yeah.
That's his fetish. Is fucking funny.
Yeah.
And I was laughing at that.
Yeah.
Like, chuckling. But it's not hysterical.
What do you mean by fetish?
Well, that's his fetish.
Fetish. There's nothing to do with fetish. Where'd you get fetish?
It doesn't have to be sexual. Like, it's not a sexual... It might be a sexual, but...
I'm pretty sure if you're going to use the word fetish, that it actually technically does mean sexual.
Does it? Let's get a dictionary. Because what I'm trying to say, anyway, is that that's something that he enjoys. It's an obscurity that he likes. It's his fetish.
Well,
which is good, because at least it's not a young boy or something.
Yeah. The one thing I think would have, I think, helped to kind of add an extra layer onto the...
That was a pedophile joke.
Okay. just in case.
Because the bishop likes small boys. Pedophile joke.
Oh, is that what you meant?
Yeah, I got you.
Get it?
No.
Let's all think about that for a second.
Mic dropped. Do you think if they had added more elements, like, this is what I was just thinking about, like, if there was more elements that were kind of aimed direct, like, direct shots aimed at the upper crust, do you think it would have made the message clearer or more enjoyable, I guess?
The message was really clear, because it's always just them trying to... I mean, like, it seems like the upper class needs to have a meal to feel like they are doing something important.
Yeah, but I mean, it was in terms of, like, what you would see in a modern-day version of this, I think it was very subtle in their performance. Like, there was only one or two instances where they were, like... It was like the driver. When the driver came in and they were talking about how you perfectly drink a dry martini, the driver came in and just gulped it down. They're like, see, no, he's a commoner. He doesn't understand.
Yeah.
Like, there was like that, maybe one other instance where it was, like, really thick, like, segregation of like rich and poor, yeah, like upper crust and commoner and things. Do you think if they had added more of that in, it would have like hindered or heightened?
I don't know, because it depends how you do it. I mean, again, like the bishop thing being a gardener, they turned him away when he was a gardener, and then all of a sudden, as soon as he's like, "But oh, sorry, I'm just I just like to dress up as a gardener."
Yeah,
and they're like, "Oh, well, come right in because you're a fucking bishop, goddammit."
Yeah,
so they're all worried about image. I mean, that was happening regularly anyway.
Yeah,
subtly and not subtly, and it was. It's like what are you trying to ask me, mate?
I don't really know. I guess it's more like the idea of if it was less subtle with its message, do you think that would have?
I think it's fine. Like, are you like, if the film is not funny to you, why should we expect it to be hilarious? Because it's a surrealist comedy that's pointing the finger at high, middle and high class people.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have to be hilarious.
No.
It's more, I mean, because it's one of those ones that's more cynical than it is funny anyway, so it's like...
Yeah, yeah. I think that's more what I'm asking. If they were laying the cynicism on a lot thicker than it was, like, do you think that would have affected your enjoyment of the film?
I'll put it this way. If I was more cynical,
yeah,
I would enjoy it even more.
Yeah.
So... I think that it's... What's the director's name?
Louis Bonnell.
Bonnell. I think that if his joke is, if you are a cynical person, you're going to fucking love the shit out of this, because I'm a cynical person. I like making movies that have... that are, like, just heaped in cynicism.
Yes.
Which is fine. I'm slightly cynical.
Yeah.
So that's why I slightly enjoy it.
Yeah. But you're not overly cynical.
But I'm not
so
overly
you're not
cynical.
So lacking it up.
I'm not going to be like... Yeah, I'm not going to say, yes, aren't upper class people fucking filthy?
Yeah. And they're all criminals.
They're all out of touch, man.
Yeah. That was a nice element, I thought, that was kind of subtly weaved in there at the beginning. And it's just out of nowhere, like, yeah, they're all just dealing cocaine.
Mm.
Like, it's just like that weird little element that's thrown in.
I like that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
where
it's just
all of
like,
a sudden that's happening.
All these guys are they're criminals. Like, to be rich, you're a criminal. Like, it's just, like, never really explicitly said. It's just, like, this little side thing. Fuck it, that's not important. We'll move on.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's good.
I love that kind of stuff where you have to catch up.
Yes, yeah.
You have to play catch up and just go with it. Because all the characters are going with it. Like, what the fuck?
And that's kind of what I'm wondering about. Like, if in a couple of days, like, after this film sat with me a little while, I'm going to get those little elements where it's like, oh, really? The fake chicken was meaning this. Like, that's what that was.
that was my favorite part of the film.
Yeah.
Was every time they sat down and every time food came out, I got really excited. Because you know that they're either going to eat food, which is just the best part of the film when they finally eat, or something super crazy is going to happen.
Yeah.
Something
bizarre is going to stop them from putting the fucking food in their mouths.
So it's so crazy that as soon as a plate comes out, the tension is just ramped up straight away. So that was probably the most successful part of the film.
Yeah.
Is just that recurring joke of as soon as plate comes out, tension ramped up, craziness.
It's good as well because it takes you a while to kind of notice as well. It's by about the third or fourth time that you're just like, wait a minute, I see what you're doing.
Yeah, you really have to repeat it.
Yeah.
Because there is literally no point beyond enjoying the scene-to-scene banter and craziness.
Mm.
So you're clinging on to something.
Yeah.
And that is the food eventually.
The heightened tension of like, are they going to get to fucking eat or not? And I mean, it's beautifully constructed as well. I think the cinematography is... I think it's very well shot, actually. When we're watching, you said, despite the fact that it's surreal, there was not many striking images.
Mm.
I totally agree with that. Like, there wasn't anything that, like, totally bizarre and standout-y in terms of visual. But the actual camera work itself, I think, was fucking fantastic.
It was very minimal, right? Like, there's nothing...
Well, there was a lot of really interesting zooms and pans, actually.
Yeah,
Lots of kind of zooms into windows, and then you'd cut to the other side and it would zoom out. Like, things like that. It was very meticulously constructed, I think. And
They certainly let it all play out because there's hardly any cuts.
Yeah.
When you're having a dialogue or you're in a room, it's always just the camera panning from one place to another.
It's a very fluid camera. It kind of seems to just kind of float in and around these scenarios, and it makes it really interesting to watch.
Really theatrical. Like a theater sense on a stage.
Mm.
I think actually I read that this this is being worked into a musical.
Oh,
this,
really?
This film.
That'd be intriguing.
Yeah, I it's who was the producer?
Sergei Silberman.
Yeah, I think apparently. Let's just fucking flat out fact check this. Where's my phone at? So, according to Wikipedia, Stephen Sondheim.
Oh shit! Okay, yeah.
Who is that person? Do
you? Yes, I do. Sweeney Todd.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay, yes.
That's my favourite of his musicals.
So, apparently, he and playwright David Ives...
Yep.
Do you know who he is?
No.
Let's look up him. Who is responsible for... you know, various things.
Sundry plays.
Yeah, you know, it's just various musical stuff, musical theatre,
theatrical the works.
You know, he's a big name.
Yeah, but Sondheim and this the masterful David Ives.
Yeah. As of 2014, they've been working on a new musical with a plot or lack of plot inspired by the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie, and also Boone Wells' 1962 film The Exterminating Angel.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, there is potentially going to be something on stage relating to this wacky, weird adventure.
That'd be really interesting to see, especially in a musical scenario.
Mm.
It would be interesting to see how they play out the dream sequences then, or like the dreams within the dreams, and like that kind of compounding effect, I guess.
It's like a...
It's very... Yeah, you're right. It's very theatrical, so it could work really
well. Always just around a fucking table, man.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Or...
People arriving at a place for dinner or... Yeah.
Super easy to do on stage.
Yeah.
But then there was... There's no... What were we talking about? We were talking about, like, the lack of visual...
Yes,
stuff.
Yeah. But there's no necessarily independent striking images or... And the colour palette as well that that they use isn't necessarily outlandish or necessarily surreal. It's a very kind of standard and realistic filmmaking approach to a surreal presentation, I guess.
I think the only time that the visuals were really surreal was when there was that transition where they're having their dinner party and then the camera is pointing a certain way, one particular way across the dining room. And then it snaps to the other side, and there's a fucking massive red curtain.
Yes, yeah.
And that pulls away to reveal a crowd.
The audience,
and then when the camera reverts back to its original shot of the dining room, it's just a dining room painted on walls.
Yes.
Without any explanation. And that kind of stuff is... I just love that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But there's not many instances that
the
when
other
that occurs.
The other thing would possibly be the army messenger telling the story of his dream, and everything was a painted soundstage of him just walking down a street, but it wasn't a real street. It was just painted backdrops and painted sides. So, like, but that works for the reality because it's like, you know, it's a dream, so it's not real. Versus like the scenario, like the stage play scenario, up until that point, we're led to believe that this is actually happening, and so that's why that I think is so shocking, but. Yeah, it's interesting.
It's a surreal thing.
It's surreal.
It's a surreal thing, and it happened.
Mm.
You know, we watched this movie.
We certainly did.
I don't know. There's not. I don't feel like there's much to talk about it.
There isn't, because there isn't necessarily a plot. So I think we've.
But even the themes are very
on the nose.
They're kind of basic. They're not. You could probably do an essay if we really tried to just nut it out, but
you'd have
but
to.
But I'm going
to
leave Roger Ebert to do that.
Yeah, and you're also
going to
end up
that.
Quoting like actual historical shit about like class struggle. versus actually the film presentation, I feel. Like, so
how do we do the podcast then?
No, I think we've done all right. Like, we've had a decent discussion about the way in which it's presented and things, so yeah.
But there's surely more to it. There's surely other avenues we can, you know, discover about this. Cole? Harvey? Harvey, do you have any words to say? Anything at all, Harvey? No.
What themes did you get from it, aside from just poking fun at upper class? And was it poking fun at upper class?
I read Roger Ebert's write-up on it, and I recommend that anybody watch this movie does read that. Because he writes so well. You know, he's just fucking amazing. But his major points were just simply talking about the idea that you have a middle or upper class that requires food and drink in order to have any meaningful, important conversation to them.
Yeah.
And the idea that talking about normals, like anything outside of that, is potentially uncivilized.
Yeah.
Or improper.
Yeah.
So they require food around a dinner table. They require drink around a dinner table in order to feel better.
Yeah.
In order to feel upper class and better than the rest of the people.
Well, it's interesting, like what you just said, like they need food and drink to be able to actually have a proper exchange of important information. It's interesting that any time in the film when important information is needed to get across between character and character, and they're not around the dinner table, it's muted in some form, whether it be a fire engine passing outside or a plane going overhead.
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, it's kind of that point of, like, if it's not around the dinner table, if it's not around the dinner party, then it's not important, and we as the audience don't give a shit.
We don't need to hear.
We don't need to. We don't care.
It was strictly used only when they were discussing, only when it came down to, like, the ambassador stuff.
No, it happened earlier in the film as well.
Yeah, when he was talking to the young girl about the terrorist stuff.
Yeah.
And then again,
well, it's points that would make you understand the scene and the scenario, and it's important information, but because it's not taking place in that civil setting of around a dinner table.
I don't know if that...
It always seems like the characters are trying to escape those real situations. They're really trying to just get the fuck away from politics, get the fuck away from reality, and just sit there in their isolated room with their close friends talking about the delicious food that they're going to enjoy.
Or how to make a proper dry martini.
Yeah, and I suppose the film is really trying to highlight the idiocy and just outright silliness of a person like that, a person that's so ready to shut themselves away or off.
Yeah.
From the reality going on around them.
Yeah.
To say that, I mean, this one, if I'm sure you're right, if we sit down and think about it and come back to it, it's going to be a better discussion. But we have a movie to watch next week, so we can't do that.
Yes.
But hang on, you didn't answer my question.
Sorry.
What
other themes did you pick up from it? Ignoring that poking the fun at that society.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, there's the inverse as well to that. Like, not only is it all the aspects that you were just talking about the upper crust and the upper class and all that kind of their needs and desires, and you're getting the inverse of the servant perspective as well, the idea of the constant needing to serve and be subservient to their employers and things, which is shown in that opening scene where they go to the restaurant to have dinner, and like the place is clearly shut up and locked, but they're like, no, we want to come in for dinner, and the fucking owner is died that morning and is laying there, like, you know, waiting for the fucking undertaker.
People are grieving,
and they're still just like, no, it's like, it's okay, we can still serve you, you can start dinner if you want. Like, that idea of you know, always wanting to do their job, I guess. Like, you also get what is it,
I suppose, the bishop who chooses to work for union wages.
Yep. The housekeeper as well is always, you know, that was sorry, just on the note of her, like, she was clearly like a 20-year-old girl that is 52. Like, That was weird.
What do you mean? She's 52, what?
Yeah, she said, like, that she's 52. Oh. That's how old the character was.
Okay, yeah. That's super crazy.
Yeah.
What about the idea of dissatisfaction? The constant chasing of pleasurable things, never reaching it. You mentioned that there's a film... Shut up, Harvey. At least in the beginning, seemed to have a running theme of people just wanting to have sex all the time.
Oh, yes.
Just wanting to and trying to. The couple before everyone arrive in the bedroom, and then they scamper off to the bushes, and then they scamper off further.
Yeah.
The woman when she's trying to cheat on her husband, and it just... They get interrupted, and then...
By the husband.
They get interrupted by the husband, then he gets the husband to leave, and then...
tries again.
And then he tries again, and...
Mm.
Is there a running theme there with also, like, just trying to have... Harvey, shush.
Shush, Harvey.
Well, is that...
Does that run into the dinner thing?
Yeah, I was about to say, is that, like, linked?
Pleasurable things in life.
Yeah. And I suppose food and drink is the easiest and most accessible one to present on screen, while still being kind of universally accessible to an audience. Whereas if it was all about, like, the wanton pleasures of sex and stuff, you'll end up with fucking Caligula. Like, it wouldn't necessarily work in that fashion. But the idea of a dinner party, I guess, and people always, like, chasing the idea of having the perfect dry martini, or, like, you know, the lamb roast has to be out of the oven at the proper time, otherwise it'll be overcooked. Like,
yeah, there's a few times that they're talking about the first time that they go to the restaurant at the start, and then later on at the dinner sequence that turns into the dream sequence on the stage, they're discussing how much they, like, the food had better be good.
Yeah.
Like, I would have the caviar, but I'm sure it's not going to be good quality.
Yeah, and that...
I would have the pate, but I'm sure it's just going to be too salty.
Yes. Nothing is as good as what they've had before, and...
Yeah. Yeah. And there's just, I don't know, is it... There's a constant, pursuit.
Yeah.
Of like, a high pleasures that are just never good enough.
Yeah, they have dissatisfaction.
Always chasing the dragon.
Yeah. But that, again, is that... That's just helping... kind of skewer the upper class, really. That's just kind of heaping onto that whole major theme behind it, I guess. Like, the overall crux of the movie. So,
I suppose, but is that just... can you only say that about upper class society? That it's only upper class who are constantly seeking pleasures and never reaching it?
I think that applies
to everyone.
Yeah, but if you put it in the context of the film where the director is making a point where he's going, look at all of these upper class people and all they do is just worry about how to sip martinis, then you have the lower class coming in and going, they just fucking drink it up, enjoy it, and get on with things. So
yeah, what's interesting about that, though, is that in real society, though, people envy the upper class and they're constantly trying to seek to be upper class.
Mm.
So does that then not speak for everyone? If you're making fun of upper class for doing it, but then everybody else wants to be them, it doesn't apply to everyone.
That's a good point. They're all hypocrites. What I was reading when I was reading up on, fuck, what's his name again? Buñuel. He seems like he likes to point out that people are hypocrites and that he is a hypocrite and everybody's a hypocrite. That's where his cynicism comes from. So it would make sense that everybody in the film is.
Everything
doesn't make sense. It's just like surrealism itself, it's just presenting a logical shit. Stuff that doesn't work, stuff that's contradictory sometimes. So, I think if we kept going, you would start to just pinpoint heaps of these instances in the film that don't make sense and are contradictory and hypocritical. But I can't be fucked.
I mean, that's what the whole film is. It's really
We've mentioned like a whole bunch of stuff, but
the whole Miranda stuff.
Yes,
the fictional nation of Miranda or whatever.
Yeah.
The Republic of Miranda.
What do you think was the purpose of that being so present throughout the film? And it really was present throughout the film. It kept coming back to
It did.
Tales of Miranda.
It did.
What do you think was the purpose? And then there was that dinner party where
the characters were rejecting that as well. They were talking about it, but I felt like they didn't really want to tackle that kind of discussion anyway as well. We getting that vibe?
Well, Fernando Rey's character in general didn't want to discuss his homeland and his home country, like, you know, of Miranda. He didn't want to get into topics because when he got into it with anyone other than his immediate friends that, you know, were constantly seen in the film, it always ended badly, and it ended with them being like, oh, I heard there are lots of Nazis living there under, like, incognito now, or I hear that the, you know, it's terribly hot there, I hear that the slave labor is fucking awful, like, all it's always negative, and it's him constantly just being like, no, no, fuck that, we're not talking about that.
Yeah, well, it did seem that he was, it was the characters trying to isolate themselves, talk about their cushy, wonderful, expensive, lavish lifestyle that they've created.
Yeah.
That allows them to block out the reality.
What I sort of got from that, like, in particular, like, obviously, the ambassador character was that he was, wanted to distance himself from, you know, the poor, like, life that was Miranda, and kind of, by getting this, you know, ambassador position in France, he bolstered himself up and put himself up on this pedestal. And, yeah, he's constantly just like, no, fuck that, we're not dealing with that.
Do you think that's symbolically something that can be said of upper class or politics at the time, maybe, where it's the idea that those with money are ignoring the constant demands and the constant questioning of, yeah, but isn't there trouble here? Aren't you poor in this sense? Isn't there suffering? Aren't you isn't there corruption?
Mm.
And his response is constantly just like, no, we're doing well economically wise, you know, we've got numbers that prove it. No, we don't have poor. No, we don't have this. And it's all like this PR. It's just, you're right, it is all about ignoring it, but do you think it goes, like, it symbolises something a little bit grander than that, where it is about upper class ignoring the plight?
If you go around any city and you go to the rich suburbs, the fences are so big, and everywhere else they're kind of small or don't have fences at all. So that is a super massive generalization, but it's true. Like, rich people have big fences, and they do want to separate themselves
walls, yeah.
So, you know, it's pretty apt. It's totally cynical to think that every rich person is like that.
Mm.
But do you think it speaks to politics as well? He's meant to be an ambassador for that country. He's meant to be...
Yet he's exploiting it. Like,
yeah,
by
and
importing.
He's ignoring... He ignores a lot of his problems. He's not honest about it.
Yeah.
And you're right, he flees from it.
Yeah. But I think, like, it's... Bonomo wanted to actually address the politics aspect of it, it'd be more the minister versus the ambassador. Like, his... Like, you know... The ambassador of a fake... Like, you know, of Miranda in France isn't actually able to do much, like, in terms of actual political power.
Yeah.
It's a diplomatic position as opposed to an actual political position.
Well, is that the statement that he's a man of influence and power, and yet he doesn't do anything or stand for anything?
He does, though. He imports cocaine and becomes a drug dealer.
He's corrupt, but you don't see, like, is that a statement? Like,
yeah.
He's a man of power, but what does he do?
But he wants
a man
the,
with a title, but what
yeah.
does he do?
But that's what they're interested in. They're interested in the title. Like, they're not interested in
the
bishop that's the gardener. They're interested in the bishop with the uniform.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all status. It's all...
I don't know.
I'm not sure
from,
if we
want to
overcomplicate it.
I don't know, but that's from the single character's point of view.
Yeah.
I'm talking about thematically.
Yeah.
Is that why he chose to use an ambassador and not a minister? Because he's a pointless politician.
No, that's what I figure, yeah.
Like, is that not a statement? If you wanted to make a statement about politics or politicians ignoring the plight of the commoner...
Let's choose someone that is just an empty employee, pretty much.
In a sense, what is the difference between, a minister or an actual politician or a leader...
Yeah.
...to an ambassador who doesn't do anything? He has the power.
And he's just like, hey, I'm here representing my country this country.
Is that a mirroring in itself of just, like, saying all politics... is nothing but titles and money, and they don't do anything.
I mean, you could read into that, but I don't think there's anything in the film that is explicitly saying that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could definitely read into it, but it's not... Yeah.
I'm just asking questions.
Just asking questions. Yeah, it's... I wouldn't go that far. But then again, I'm not...
Not,
I could be more
not
cynical.
Countering it.
If I was more cynical, maybe I would.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the job of the viewer in these films is to simply try and
keep up.
Well, trying to assess the point of view of the artist that's making the piece.
Yeah.
Not to side with them necessarily, or like start throwing fucking fruit at it.
No,
you're not doing that. I think my takeaway from this film is to try and understand the guy. I keep forgetting his name.
Louis Bonnell.
But now, if I fucking remember his name, that's a good start. Shit. Yeah, I don't know. This to me is like a subtle film, and it's complex, so it's
thumbs up.
It was a good movie. It was, really was. It was a good film.
Yeah.
But I think
it's a lot to digest.
It's too much to digest in fucking 50 or 40 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
Right after watching it.
Yeah.
It's more, I feel like that this film, if we keep watching, it'll be like watching a Bergman
thing. Yeah.
Where it's just like you start to learn about the person, the director, the more you watch their films. And the more you watch their films, the more they just make sense.
Yes.
Because you need to understand the artist first.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Like, yeah, with Bergman, like we did Seven Seal first, and we didn't quite know what to make of that film. Then we did Autumn Sonata, and we were starting to get it. And then by Cries and Whispers, we're like, yeah, no, we got Bergman now. Like, we see.
Well, we get him enough to have him be accessible.
Yes, yes, and we can actually understand where he's coming from, what he's doing, and attempt to dissect. Whereas we're encountering Bonnell for the first time here. We've got him a shitload in the collection. He's got a lot of films in there, so...
Well, that's good, because I'm prepared to watch Surrealism at length.
Yeah.
But, of course, because it's so fucking weird, you really have to get into it.
Yeah.
So I'm excited. It'll be exciting to see his next film.
Yes.
So I want to understand... I'm going to give this guy a good chance. I want to understand the man.
Yeah.
So that I can understand his art, but it's going to take a while because it seems like it's complex.
Mm. Well, and yeah, I'd recommend, I'm 100% sure it's up on YouTube, I would recommend going and having a look at the 1929 short film he did with Dali, Unchien Andalou. I'll post a link to that actually through the Twitter page as well. So.
Okay, sweet.
Yeah.
Who was the author of The Third Policeman? Do you remember?
Flann O'Brien,
yeah. So that's also a recommendation for people that want to get into the Surrealist movement. That's just, there's no film, it's a book.
Yep.
But it's a fucking great book.
Mm. Well, I figure anyone who's, like, listening to Criterion enjoys reading at the same time, so... Yeah, like...
They like literature?
You think? Yes. You would assume as much. Well, I guess you want to hear a little bit of trivia.
Yeah, sure. That's great.
All right. Yeah. So the film was nominated for 2 Academy Awards. Yeah, so it was nominated for Best Screenplay, and it won Best Foreign Language Film in 1973. It was also nominated for Best Foreign Language Film at the Golden Globes, which it didn't win, but it did win Best Screenplay and Best Actress at the 1974 BAFTAs, as well as being nominated for Best Director, Best Film, and Best Soundtrack. And
who got the Best Actress?
Drunk Girl?
Stéphane Audran. Whoever...
I'm going to find that out.
But here's the thing, like, if we look up...
She's a brunette.
Alice. The woman who played Alice. Exactly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The redhead.
She was redhead?
Yeah. The wife who ran off into the bushes to have sex. And, yeah, and the film was also recognised as one of the top foreign films of the year by the National Board of Review. But yeah, so that is the... It's a fairly lauded film, as we were mentioning earlier. But actual trivia now, in an interview...
Well, it's like 8 out of 10 on IMDb, 98% on Rotten Tomatoes, and Roger Ebert gave it 4 out of 4 stars, so...
Yeah.
Everyone likes this film.
Yes.
And thinks it's really important.
Yeah.
What would you give it out of 10?
Out of 10?
Yeah. What would you give it out of 1,002?
1,002?
Yeah.
I don't know. out of 10, I'd probably give it... Probably I'd give it a 7.5 or an 8. Like, for what it is, it achieves it absolutely perfectly. Whether or not I enjoy... It's like, it's a good example of that kind of reviewing. Is like The Revenant. Like, The Revenant is an exceptionally well-made film. I didn't necessarily enjoy it, but I can still appreciate it for the wonderful piece of filmmaking that it is.
Like Kubrick.
Yes. Like, you, not everyone enjoys Kubrick, but everyone agrees he's a fucking master.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool, man.
Yeah, so we'll move on with the actual trivia. In an interview, John Landis confessed that the film is one of his favourites of all time and that the dreams within the dreams gag in An American Werewolf in London was heavily inspired by this film. Yeah.
The dream thing is always really touchy because you go back, it's like super cliche now, so that, yes, even if you go back into like the back catalogue of cinema and you find that, the instances of that, you're still just like, oh, jeez.
Yeah, weirdly, I didn't find it grating with this because it worked to serve the narrative and to serve the presentation. It worked really well. So it wasn't that ugh kind of thing here.
It wasn't a cop-out.
No.
It never felt like a cop-out.
Hmm. Louis Bonuel is credited for creating the sound effects for the film, which is interesting because he was almost deaf at the time of making it.
Huh.
Yeah, he was in his late 60s when he made this.
That's crazy.
Hmm. The movie includes three of Bonuel's recurring dreams: a dream of being on stage and forgetting his lines, a dream of meeting his dead cousin in the street and following him into a house of cobwebs, and a dream of waking up to see his dead parents staring at him. So he was an interesting fellow.
Yeah, yeah, wow.
Yep. And the last bit of trivia is that the original title for the film was Bourgeoisie Enchantment.
I like this title. Yeah,
the discreet charm works nicely.
Yeah.
Mm. But we'll move on to the actual Criterion Edition itself. So unfortunately, the 2-disc DVD from Criterion is out of print at the moment. And I think for good, I think it's one they lost the licensing to. But if you're able to find a copy of it, it comes
maybe
with...
Maybe the licensing was bought up by a musical troupe that was going to...
Steven Sondheim!
Yeah.
But the Criterion Edition does come with the following special features. The Castaways on the Streets of Providence from 1970, a 24-minute documentary homage to Bonuel by his longtime friend Arturo Rispin and Rafael Casadendo. Speaking of Bonuel, from 2000, a new 98-minute documentary on the life and work of Bonuel by José Luis López Linares and Javier Rio.
Good job, those hard words.
Yeah, as well as the original theatrical trailer, new and improved English subtitles, and the usual booklet and essays that Criterion usually do.
Mm.
Yes.
Hey, maybe we should have a shout-out to people that wrote in.
I was thinking that, but we're already 2 weeks in advance now. Like, we'd already... Cries and Whispers came out last week when we got all the emails, so it's now, like, later on.
Doesn't matter. We should still kind of recognise it, right?
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah... Thank you to anyone that sent in an email or hit us up on Twitter or through iTunes or kind of reached out to us in any way when we hit our 100th episode. It kind of meant a lot to us.
Yeah, it really did. Yeah, thank you. And also, there was some helpful criticism about,
yeah,
you know, like when we laugh, the fucking levels are a bit too out of whack, so we can try and fix that up. But
I thought that was very sweet that somebody... the only criticism they had was that the laughter was too loud, like just on audio levels. From what I understand, nobody has yet complained about the amount of burps.
No, that's true.
No, but that's why would you do that?
It just adds
it's
to the character.
It's a plus. Like, it's definitely a plus. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, it doesn't say it's very sweet.
Because
everybody else there gets it.
Yeah. Oh, if only I had a burp right now.
It's been a while since we've been opening beer cans and stuff on the episodes. We've kind of both cut back on drinking a bit. So.
I would have liked to have taken a tally.
Yeah.
How many beers have been opened on the podcast show so far.
It used to be a lot.
Don't judge me.
Which is maybe why we're now better at dissecting films, because we're not...
We didn't do that good a job.
That's true.
But it was a toughie.
Yeah.
But it is kind of nice. We were talking in the car on the way over here that you had an email from somebody who said that they liked the show because it felt like hanging out on the couch with mates who had an old crotchety dog.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really sweet now, and this is why we brought Harvey again, because now I feel like he has to be here.
Yeah, he's now part of the podcast now for sure. Constantly roaming the background and the odd bark.
The
odd
bark!
Yeah.
Weighing
in his opinions.
But Tom and I were talking in the car on the way over, and we thought that it's actually quite nice now, because having had some feedback, it feels like we are sitting on the couch with friends.
Yeah.
And more than just us now.
Mm.
So it is kind of nice.
Yeah, it's super moving. I love it.
Yeah, thank you all, and thanks for listening, and those that reached out to us, it meant a lot. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. But yeah, I guess that'll wrap us up for this week's episode. Looking at Louis Bonuel's The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie.
Bonuel.
Yeah, we actually had to look up on Google like how to pronounce the name.
So don't look like idiots or anything.
Yeah.
You don't remember his fucking name. Mm.
But we will be back next week when we look at an old American classic, The Lady Eve by Preston Sturges.
So, have you seen that?
No, I have not. Okay. I know it's kind of an American kind of classic film, so it should be interesting. All bit right. of fun.
Let's leave it there.
Yeah. But yeah, if you have any comments or queries or anything, please hit us up on Twitter at Criterion Quest or send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com. Other than that, we will see you next week. For this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom.
I'm Cole.
See you next time.